24 and a half minutes after the hour. It is a Thursday morning. I think it's Thursday. Last time I checked, they come so fast. It's Thursday either Thursday again or Thursday still. I'm not sure. But Robbie's with us. Pastor Robbie, an Anglican pastor from Ashburn, Virginia. That's where his church is. That's where his church is in Fairfax. But it's all those. How big is Ashburn, Robbie?
Well, Ashburn's part of Loudoun County. It's in Loudoun County, mm-hmm. and I'm not too sure how big it is, but it's one of the wealthiest counties in all of America, mm-hmm. and it's suburbs of Washington, D.C., and I don't know how we found ourselves here. I guess the Lord called us to a church close by here mm-hmm. before he called us back to Fairfax. So we've been from Alexandria to Ashburn and now serving in Fairfax, Virginia. It's good to be with you, Jim and Dave. Always a pleasure to be on the Broken Road.
Nice to have you, too. It's a joy. Each Thursday, we learn stuff from you. Robbie is the executive director of Preserving Bible Time, should mention that. And we've been traveling through Matthew 22 for a while here. Mm-hmm. And just to recap, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I know Matthew is not strictly chronological in its path. But Jesus is in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount teaching during Passion Week. So Palm Sunday is past, and this is like the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And he's fair game for the Jewish establishment. Because as I would interpret it, they're still trying to catch him because they're planning his arrest and charging him with something. So while he's teaching at the temple, it seems like he's made himself a target. And he's just dispatched the Sadducees. They came to him, and he totally embarrassed them. And so the Pharisees are taking their turn now. Are they a little wary of who Jesus is at this point?
Absolutely. And they've got their positional authority structure completely upside down. You get the impression that they're in it with Rome. Last week, we talked about paying taxes to Caesar or not. And Jesus asked them for a coin, and there with him are the Pharisees, their disciples, and the Herodians, so those who were sympathetic with Rome. And to your point, with the context of being on the Temple Mount, in chapter 24 of Matthew, verse 1, we see Jesus left the Temple Mount and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. So there's your context that, 22:23 of Matthew is up around the Temple Mount complex.
And Passion Week.
Yeah, yeah. And then he returns, of course. You've got the woes to the scribes and the Pharisees. You've got the signs of the ends of time. The day and the hour not known comes in Matthew 24. And then he tells the parable of the 10 virgins and the sheep and the goats, the separation, so it's judgment. And he gets into some pretty harsh words for the religious leaders.
Well, and he's not been a fan of theirs all the way through his ministry. He's has many an occasion where they have tried to put him to the test, and he's wiggled out brilliantly and made his own point with them that the religious establishment is wrong, needs to be reformed, needs to be essentially thrown out on its ear. And the new kingdom brought in, and a new way to be justified before God, which is the whole animal sacrifice system. John the Baptist, that was his message, and Jesus, of course, amplified that. So these are adversaries of his here.
Yeah, yeah, and it's the religious elite, and those. It's interesting, an enemy of my enemy is my friend. You've heard that expression. Mm-hmm. So to have the Pharisees hanging out with the Herodians to try to trap Jesus is what we looked at with paying taxes to Caesar last week in Matthew 22. It's fascinating that they're bringing the Herodians with them.
Now, who were the Herodians? This is Herod Antipas, the son of Herod the Great at this point. Are these is it a political party? Is it just a group of people allied with Rome? Are they Greeks? Are they what?
Yeah, Hellenistic Jews. So you've got Jewish people with Hellenistic tendencies with an allegiance or a sympathy at least towards Rome. And they're in Galilee and they're in Jerusalem and they're hostile to Jesus. And that's what they have in common with the Pharisees.
And yet a big chunk of them will be won over into the first church in Jerusalem, because we talked about the Hellenistic Jews there and how they felt discriminated against. So this is a kind of an outlier group that eventually will be welcomed into the church.
Yeah, and some scholars believe that they are a part of a public political authority that is sympathetic to Herod Antipas. You're right, this isn't Herod the Great, because he's long dead, but this is Herod Antipas, and the kingdom is kind of divided between the Herods. So you've got Herod Philip in the north and Herod Antipas, and you've got this division. But today, I mean, I think it's an interesting point to look at where Jesus is heading, because in Matthew 22, where we've been camping out, the next scene that we have after the Herodians and the Pharisees is the Sadducees asking about the resurrection. And the Sadducees are the religious group that does not hold to the resurrection of the dead. And they, too, are trying to trap Jesus by asking him about this woman who's had seven husbands. Whose wife will she be in the kingdom to come? And they're not interested in an answer. They're looking to trip Jesus up in his theology.
Did they not accept the whole idea of an afterlife?
They did not. And you know, you've heard the old Sunday school joke. The Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection, and that's why they are sad, you see.
Yeah. hadn't heard that.
And it says this right here in the text, actually, in chapter 22 of Matthew, verse 23. It says, the same day Jesus came to him, the Sadducees came to him who say there is no resurrection. And they asked him a question, saying, Teacher, Moses said if a man dies having no children, and then they try to trap him. But there it is. The comma, who say there is no resurrection, comma. So there's your definition of the Sadducees and their kind of bent. And this comes right on the heels of the Herodians and the Pharisees asking, or trying to trap Jesus, asking, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? And this is where we get, you know, render to Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and unto God those things that are God's.
And just another political point here, too, because I understand that the Sadducees ran the Sanhedrin, which is like the Supreme Court of Israel. And it was they who would bring charges against Jesus later in the week. So I guess maybe both camps are interested in his legal positions with respect to the law of Moses so they can trap him. But they themselves are pitted against each other, are they not?
Yeah, I mean, it's a mess. And then you've got the zealots who are, you know, armed people who are trying to overthrow Rome to bring about God's kingdom. And we've got zealots in the 12 disciples, by the way. And we've got zealotry behavior. There's a whole debate of how many swords they should bring to the Garden of Gethsemane, that whole thing. And so it's a mixed bag in terms of politics. And then the Essenes, which are separatists. So you've got the zealots, the separatists, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Herodians, which are Hellenistic Jews. And it's really mixed bag of power struggles. And, you know, in all this systemic politicking and power, God gets lost in the mix. I mean, isn't the temple, the whole point of the temple is to worship God, to offer sacrifice? And so this is where all of this is pointing to, I believe, Matthew 22, beginning at verse 34, which I'd like to focus on today, which is the great commandment. In verse 34, you see the Pharisees again. But when the Pharisees heard that he, Jesus, had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. Again, a friend, an enemy of my enemy is my friend. Mm. And then verse 35, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, you know, like lawyers do, to test him. And the question is simply this: Teacher, which is the great commandment of the law? And he said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. Now, Jesus adds mind here from Deuteronomy. the commandments in Deuteronomy and Exodus, the Ten Commandments, he's adding mind, which I think is fascinating. And it could be that he's in the midst of some of these Hellenistic Jews. So Jesus says, this is the great and the first commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. So why does Jesus have to sum up the law?
Why did this guy ask, why would he assume that one commandment is greater than another? I mean, this seems like he's laying a trap again. He wants Jesus to run afoul of this and violate some aspect of Moses' law.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're trying to trap him. I mean, you can see this carry over into chapter 23 as well, where Jesus rebukes the Pharisees and the religious leaders, specifically the Pharisees, because he says to them, you guys are tithing. And we talked a little bit about tithing last week. And it repeats itself again, where Jesus rebukes the people in 23:23. He says, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites. This is the issue, the hypocrisy. And now we're introduced with another religious group, the scribes. He calls them hypocrites. He says, for you tithe mint, dill, cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law. And that's the issue. They're neglecting the law. Specifically, Jesus is saying the weightier matters. I mean, keep in mind, tithing is not one of the Ten Commandments. And Jesus goes on to say, justice and mercy and faithfulness, these you ought to have done without neglecting the others. In other words, yes, you should pay your tithe, but you should not neglect the weightier matters of the law. You should be doing all of this, and you're not doing it well. You're not actually keeping the law. Number one, you're tithing to appear religious, but you're not actually keeping the law. That's why they're hypocrites, by the way. Hmm. He calls them blind guides. He says, you're straining out a gnat and you're swallowing a camel. So this is why in 22, I believe that Jesus is summing up the law for those, this lawyer in particular, who's trying to trap him.
So he ties the two together, and then he says, these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. So he's taking this beyond the Ten Commandments and beyond the law of Moses and including the prophets. I'm not sure I understand that fully. But apparently he is saying that, or implying that, if you obey those laws, that is the great commandment and the second, the rest are inferior laws. Or maybe if you can get away with just the first two, you're good on the rest. Or if you do the first two, you're a changed person and you will naturally conform to the other laws. I mean, what's the point of pointing out a great commandment here?
Well, first of all, it's been said that every commandment hinges on the first. So every commandment hinges on, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. So this is Exodus 20, verses 2 and 3. So you can't break any commandment without breaking the first commandment.
Ah.
Every time you break a commandment, you're first breaking the first commandment. This is the God who has given you these commandments. So if you break any other commandment, you are in effect putting yourself in the position of not listening to God or not obeying God or not loving God. And therefore, you're putting yourself in the position of God, or you're putting the thing that you're doing as an idol of worship into the position of God.
So that explains it beautifully. Yes, clear to me now. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and this is the issue. They're not getting loving God right, but they're also not loving their neighbor well. And if you look at the Ten Commandments, and I know you've been around long enough that this is, you know, back to Sunday school 101, right? The first four commandments have to do with our relationship between us and God. The last six commandments have to do with our relationship with one another. So it's the vertical relationship and the horizontal. So when he sums up the law and adds the second is like it, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, he really is invoking the last six commandments.
This is like their constitution. This is like the backbone of their culture being formed while they're in the desert. And here it is now where, let's see, 1,500 years later?
Yeah.
And it has been ruptured. It's been ruptured by the culture and disobedience.
Absolutely. And I think we're still doing it today because, you know, as Christians, we get caught up or can get caught up, or some of us Christians can do this, where we look at the Old Testament and we say, well, that's the Old Covenant. We're not under the Old Covenant anymore. We're under the New Covenant. Things like Sabbath and tithing. And it's fascinating to me that, and this is a subject for another day, but Sabbath gets thrown by the wayside, and that's one of the Ten Commandments. That's one of the big ten. I mean, keeping the Sabbath day holy.
That might be the one that they concentrated on in the Israeli culture, because the Sabbath has more strict rules: how far you can walk, how many candles you can light, how many, you know, how much, what constitutes work on the Sabbath. They seem preoccupied with that one commandment.
Yeah. And I believe that Jesus rewires how we are to read and interpret the law. I do believe that. But I also believe what Jesus himself said about the law. And by the way, this is our context. This is Matthew chapter 5, verse 17. Jesus said, "Think not that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I came not to destroy, but to fulfill." So you've heard it said, you know, what is the law? How do you read it? So the Jews were very concerned about how, not only that you know the law, they had it memorized, but how do you interpret it? How do you put it into practice? And so when Jesus comes to fulfill the law, not to abolish the law, we are still bound to keep the law, not because it saves us, not that because it makes us righteous. You've been saved by grace through faith, not by your works, not by works of the law, lest anyone should brag about it or boast about it. But just because we're saved doesn't mean we don't have to obey God and his law. I mean, I think that's ludicrous. And I think that we are can be, the church can be very selective. Things like tithing, which is a law, by the way. I mean, it's this idea that we're, well, when we talk about the law, are we talking about 613, the mitzvot? Are we talking about the five books of Moses? You know, are we talking about the Ten Commandments? I mean, it's important to think about the law. I think certainly the ten, the big ten, it's important to focus on those. These are the ones that God tells the Israelites to keep. There's certainly the 613, but then Jesus boils it all down to two. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, your soul, your strength. But we don't neglect the law. We still should not murder. We still should not commit adultery, and we should take a day off.
Well, you're talking about the first four commandments being vertical and the next six being horizontal. That is that they went from left to right and front to back, clear through the culture, and it had to do with relationships with people. It seems to me then, and is it fair to say that the Jewish culture was preoccupied with the letter of the law? In fact, the rabbis added to it in something called the Midrash, which was published, first written around 200 AD, but it was all the rabbis talking and interpreting the law, but forgetting the spiritual aspect, the vertical part.
And I believe that this is exactly what the Pharisees have been doing, which is why Jesus in chapter 23, verse 23, rebukes them for being so meticulous with their tithing, yet neglecting loving their neighbor well. I mean, what is the weightier parts of the law, according to verse 23? Mm-hmm. It's mercy, it's faithfulness, it's all the things that Jesus is saying to them that they're not doing. He says, you should have done these things. You should have exercised justice. You should have been merciful, and you should have been faithful, but you weren't. And this is coming on the heels of him summarizing the law, love your neighbor as yourself. And so if we are to love our neighbors, it means showing our neighbors justice. It means being merciful to our neighbors. It's being faithful. And so we can't neglect all of the law, is what he's saying. And that's why he calls them blind guides and hypocrites.
Learn something here. This is deeper. I mean, it's so easy to just read over this quickly and lose sight of all the passions and adversarial relationships and drama going on here.
Yeah.
We read it so easily and we just skip through it, but it's in an incredibly complex situation that both the Pharisees and the Sadducees and Jesus find themselves in because they're anticipating this confrontation later in the week. Jesus knows it's coming. His disciples have seen hints of it, but they haven't really grasped the importance, the significance, the horror of it. But the Pharisees know what they're about. I should say the Sadducees. Did they run the Sanhedrin, to your knowledge? Have you done some research into that?
You know, I haven't done a whole lot of research. I think I do remember what you're saying to be true, that they were in that. I think Doug taught a little bit more about that.
Mm-hmm.
But chapter 23, I mean, this is one of the, you know, this is the context when Jesus gets into the woes to the scribes and the Pharisees, calling them again hypocrites. He's close enough to the temple that you can see the Mount of Olives and the tombs of the prophets, and David's tomb is there. And they would literally whitewash these tombs. They would bleach them so that when the pilgrims came into Jerusalem, they would not accidentally step over a grave, which would make you impure, and mm-hmm. you wouldn't be able to offer your sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And also, because so many pilgrims were coming to Jerusalem, and the people who were buried on the Mount of Olives had front row seats for the resurrection. And so these tombs were bleached to make the city look beautiful. And Jesus was the used PowerPoint before PowerPoint was mm-hmm. cool, the power of pointing. And he says to them, you are whitewashed tombs. You outwardly appear beautiful, but within you're full of dead people's bones and all uncleanliness. So you also outwardly appear righteous to others. That's, by the way, why they're tithing their dill and cumin, because that can be seen, but them showing mercy or being faithful or, you know, being just cannot always be seen.
It was just the gesture of tithing.
Right. Yeah. This is why, you know, you get the parade of everyone putting their offerings in the box. And in real time, these rich, wealthy people are putting their money in the money box. And this widow comes and puts in her two mites. And Jesus makes the point, she's given more than all the rest of you. Well, what comes right before that? Jesus says that you guys are devouring widows' houses. In other words, you're not taking care of the widow. And here it is in real time, an actual occurrence. A widow comes and puts everything she has into the treasury. And he says, see, she's done more than all of you. In other words, you guys are faking that you're keeping the law, but by no means are you holding to it.
And not to open a fresh discussion, but the role of women in that society is front and center there. Because without a husband, without sons, they were basically cast off. I'm reminded by some of the movies I've seen about American Indians and what happened to aged women in particular. They were camp followers just begging for scraps. So this woman would have, that's why they identify her as a widow. It says a whole lot about the life she's having to live and the struggle she's contending with. And yet she's giving everything she had. So maybe a minor point, but still the great commandment, the great commandment.
Yeah. So here we've got, do we keep the law or we don't keep the law. How do we keep the law? What is the law? And Jesus says the commandments, all of them, can be summed up into these two things. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, your soul, your strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Upon these two things hang all the law and the commandments. I think we're still obligated to it. And if we do this, we would do well.
Mm-hmm. Well, we might just remind everybody that the Old and New Testament is kind of an artificial division. It's one highly interconnected story from Genesis to Revelation. And to divide it artificially, you kind of lose the Old Testament. We put history to rest in our minds, and we look forward. And you got to look backwards and look at the whole Bible as a uniform whole. And Robbie, we've learned something. Thanks very much for bringing that to us today. And we'll look forward to next week. Okay? Hope it goes well for you.
Indeed. Pleasure to be with you, Jim and David, on the Broken Road. Guy. Always a joy and a pleasure.
Yeah. Bye-bye.